Explaining Explainability. In this podcast, we bring together the different disciplines of the Collaborative Research Center Constructing Explainability. Two researchers discuss a concept around explainability from their point of view, moderated by Professor Britta Wrede.
Yeah, welcome to the first episode of our podcast. My name is Britta Wrede. I am head of the Medical Assistive Systems Group at the Medical School here in Bielefeld University, and I am principal investigator of the Public Relations Project and of two other research projects in the Collaborative Research Center Constructing Explainability. So in this first episode, we enter the topic of explainability from two different perspectives, that of computer science and that of linguistics. My guests today are the speakers of the Collaborative Research Center, Professor Katharina Rohrfink, a psycholinguist at Paderborn University, and Professor Philipp Zimiano, computer scientist at Bielefeld University. The issues we are dealing with today are the research goals you are pursuing in the field of explainability, the motivation that drives you, and the challenges you are facing.
Katharina Rohrfink is full professor of psycholinguistics at the Paderborn University, where she is heading the Sprachspiellabor for research on language development in children. She is involved in interdisciplinary and international projects in which she is investigating multimodal social interaction, especially the process of scaffolding the interaction partner, also how robotic partners can achieve it. Her research currently focuses on interactive adaptivity.
Hello, Katharina.
Hello.
Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
Philipp Zimiano is full professor for computer science at Bielefeld University. He leads the Semantic Computing Group at the Cognitive Interaction Technology Center. His fields of research include knowledge representation and engineering, natural language processing, knowledge acquisition, and computational argumentation. He is co-founder of two spin-offs, Simalytics and Mercury AI.
Hello, Philipp. Nice to have you here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, thank you both for coming here. This is our first podcast, so I'm very glad you made it here. And actually, my first question goes to Katharina. So, you were actually the driving force behind the idea of this CRC, Constructing Explainability. And to be honest, at the beginning, I was surprised by this topic because I didn't have it on my map. But also I thought that, well, explainability, XAI, well, that's a computer science topic. So what made you aware of this topic? Can you remember?
I think, yes, it was some years ago. We were writing a proposal for a huge research center. And the argumentation there was that intelligent artificial systems should evoke trust in people, in humans. And the way of how to do it was they should explain. They should explain themselves and they should explain many things to people. And then people will trust them. So it was quite a simple story, but I didn't buy it and wanted know more about is it really a good basis for trust to have things explained? And is it really so simple that an explanation itself, it actually causes trust? So it is not that a focus of our TRR, the trust, but the explanation itself, it got a focus because it is very interesting to think about how an explanation works and how it is an interaction, a social interaction, and maybe a very specific way of socially interact with each other. Maybe, for example, building trust.
Yeah. So, Philipp, do you see a similar interest from your perspective as a computer scientist, or where does your interest come from here in the CRC?
Well, the interest, generally speaking, of computer scientists is always in you know, understanding phenomena to a degree that makes it possible to formalize and implement. So that's always what drives our sort of research interest. In this particular question, as Katarina has already said, the one interesting aspect of explanations is that this is a very social phenomenon that in some sense is quite natural in a human-human setting. So we are very used to giving explanations, and it's part of the social expectations that we have already to provide such things. If we do something and we don't meet expectations, then it's a natural thing that comes to us to explain maybe why we didn't meet a certain expectation of our partner or of other people we interact with. But of course, machines don't have basically this impulse to explain, okay? Mm-hmm. And for us, this is a quite novel topic to try to see what does it mean to transfer something is inherently human and part of our everyday kind of interactions into the realm of man-machine or human-machine interaction.
Yeah. So you just said it yourself. It's actually new. So what kind of research or insights from your previous research, actually both of you, what kind of insights you have already would you bring in or have you brought in to this endeavor? So you have worked on argumentation, for example. So what are the aspects of argumentation that it seems obvious that argumentation should be part of explanation, but you just talked also about the social aspects. So how do you think you can achieve this?
Well, on my side, I've been working for quite some time on, as you mentioned, computational argumentation. So I'm leading a national program in this area, and argumentation is related to explanation in some sense. Argumentation has a persuasive element. So typically we argument in order to convince someone else or an audience about something that we think the audience should acknowledge or be convinced of. But many of the mechanisms underlying are what we hypothesize that there are similarities in the mechanisms how we argument or how we explain. The main difference is that when we explain, this is not necessarily persuasive. We're trying to induce some knowledge or create some knowledge in the mind of the person that receives our explanations. But we're not necessarily trying to persuade the receiver of the explanation in any way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, sometimes we do.
We might, but where in argumentation it's quite clear that argumentation per se is about arguing, justifying certain standpoints. That's what argumentation is for. Explanation is different. It's not necessarily something that we do to justify a standpoint, but in order simply to create some knowledge in the mind of the person receiving our explanation.
Actually, I do see a crucial difference between argumentation and explanations. And this is that in explanation, you really need to adapt to your addressee. So because it is the explanation is all about understanding, so you enable or you make the addressee comprehend something, and you cannot make it if the other person is not working with you toward the understanding. So I think that argumentation is more about exchanging good arguments and reasons about something. But the explanation process, I would say, is much more complex because much more kind of aligned between the two persons. And that's why I bring in my perspective on social interaction and scaffolding. So basically learning processes. In my previous research, I was concerned with how children acquire language and come to meaningful utterances, basically the whole research area is very much focusing on social interaction because children cannot do it without the support of a knowledgeable person. And for this TRR or CRC, as you mentioned, we are turning it in the other way around. So we are looking how the competent partner, the explainer, can maybe explain something to the less knowledgeable partner, which is the explainee. And how they are adapting to each other to work really towards the understanding. And I think maybe persuasion is something that could be seen as similar to understanding because it is also a goal of this interaction. But I think in argumentation, it is more about the exchanging and reasoning. But in explaining, it's really more about being scaffolded, so being really helped to understand something and learning to understand something.
I just realized when you both were talking, I just realized that what came to my mind was political debate on TV. And that seems to be more like argumentation. But yeah, I just thought that maybe it would be great to have actually explanations on TV because that seems to be way more, I don't know, efficient also, right? Because maybe something new occurs. What would you see maybe as an, of course, explainability of AI seems to be important in all kinds of applications, but are there any applications or domains where you think it's especially important?
I wouldn't single out. I mean there are obvious cases where this is needed, and without going into specific details, I mean, if we look at, for example, the GDPR law of the European Union, I mean, in the Datenschutzgrundverordnung for the German audience, it makes clear that there are many domains where AI systems might contribute to taking decisions that really have a deeper impact on the life of people. And these are those domains where, in particular, everyone, we would wish a higher transparency or accountability of decisions to which AI systems have contributed. And well, what are examples? I mean, you know, I mean, healthcare, health related topics, but might be also legal issues, might be, I don't know, decisions on whether people get a job or don't get a job. I mean, all these things that have, you know, deeper impact on the course of life of people. These are the domains where explanatory transparency is of key importance.
I now somewhat deviate from our plan, but I the way you just phrase it, you don't mean it that way, sorry. But it sounds a bit like patriarchy. So like, yeah, we have an AI, we take a decision. Now we need an AI that can explain it to us so that you sort of comply to it. I think that's not the way it's probably intended. You understand what I mean? So explanation, making AI even better so we can have better explanations for compliance reasons.
I'm not suggesting that compliance is the only reason that we would look into explanations, but I think it's an important reason. I mean, compliance, I mean, the law always in some sense reflects our current societal thinking about technology. And so the GDPR is simply putting into law what, you know, where it seems to be societal consensus about that if you use AI systems at larger scale to do recommendations or influence decision making, then yes, we need transparency. So I think that compliance is an important aspect of all of that.
Mm. But also, wouldn't it be also the other way around? So one thing is, of course, understanding, but the other way around might also be, at least in XAI, that we want the explainee to be able maybe also to understand what is going on in the AI system and maybe to see that there are biases or problems in the way the AI has come to a decision.
That is something I wanted to mention because, yes, I think that's also the possibility. But as Philip mentioned, I mean, the way is the making something transparent. So transparency is the way. And then for what purpose you make some things transparent, it can be to achieve compliance. But it can also be a good basis for, negotiating actually who is now taking over. So, for example, imagine that you have a first data analysis provided by the AI. Then it explains maybe to you on what basis it was doing in, and now you can as an expert maybe you can judge. Can I take from here? And for example, make a decision, or should I maybe ask another expert, a human expert, to help me as well? And also, I think this negotiation, I would like to stress this even once more, because I think in current developments, our role as humans and in our agency, we are going kind of being overwhelmed by the capabilities that the XAI is providing us. And maybe we are over-trusting them. So, okay, they are doing cool stuff. So let's do them the job. But it is important that the humans still are on the in the control of their decisions and really oversee on what basis the assistance is here and how to maybe take over and to control the situation even better.
So thank you for this motivation actually and overview of well of the research we are doing here. And we will now talk about the research that is carried out in the CRC in more detail. So maybe Philip, there are actually increasingly new types of explainable AI approaches around, and many of them become even more interactive, so you can play around, change values, and so on. But still, what would you see as the most striking difference between the research here in the center and what is out there currently, even if it is more interactive? Do you see, can you, is it possible to give it a clear name of what is different?
I think we, here in our center, we're looking a lot into the into what we call the explainee. Mm-hmm. I think this is this is quite a unique thing, because you can do a lot of research. I mean, it might be paradox, but there's a lot of research out there that doesn't care at all about the receiver of an explanation. Mm-hmm. I mean, this seems completely wrong, but it is the case. Okay, and you can do a lot of research in explainability without ever thinking about what does my explanation do to the receiver of the explanation. But this is not what we do here. So we try to look in particular into the, we look at the explanation process also from the perspective of the person that is receiving the explanation, looking at how can the person influence or shape the process. And then this leads to looking into all sort of things that you find that no one in the literature has looked like. For example, I mean, even today I was discussing with one of my students, there is typically in machine learning, people use the notion of feature importance. So what are important features, okay? And then my student was saying today to me, I couldn't find anything in the literature. Like, how do you tell a human how important a feature is and how do you do that? So his first experiments were saying, this feature has a value of 009 in the model. And then I said, well, if you do that, no one can, this doesn't empower anyone to do anything, because that's a completely technical way of phrasing it. So we couldn't find any experiments out there right now on how do you tell someone or how do you explain that a certain feature is maybe important and how important it is.
But what would you have expected? So any kind of, I don't know, stress or formulation for that? Or?
Well, the thing is that, I mean, we're developing a system where part of it is a user can ask the question like, what are the important factors that go into that decision? Okay. And the first shot was simply to say, well, this feature has a weight of 009. And then I said to my student, well, this is, can you look for, can we explore what are alternative ways? And there would be many. You could say, this feature is more important than this other one and less important than the other one. Or compared to the most important feature, this one has a 25% impact into the model. So you start making
contrasts.
Yeah. But if you look at the literature, you don't find anything about that. So people assume that, you know, the notion of feature importance is enough. But it doesn't say anything about how would an explainee be able to turn this into something that really empowers the explainee to understand something about how all these different features play together, basically. Mm-hmm. And this, for example, examining the notion of contrast in explanation, I think that's something that is under-researched.
Okay.
That's one example.
I'm just looking at Katharina. You can't see it here, but because I know that she's researching actually together with me, but it's her research question on contrasts in explaining. And yeah, I don't know, maybe you can add something here.
Well, this is a wonderful way of basically providing or explaining, because then by contrasting something, you are providing basically more context to what is explained. And you focus basically from one area that is concerned with your expectations. So, for example, this red one that you think of, but forget about it. Now we are talking about the green one, right? So you address the expectation about the red one, but you are turning then the attention and all the thinking to the green one. And this is really a very nice way of guiding somebody through a particular way of information sequence. And I think contrasting is working very well, and we are investigating in our project exactly that. So we are also focusing on verbal means for contrasting, and interestingly, one of way to put a contrast is to negate something. So telling this red one or not the red one, right? So to negate something. And negation is always connotated with something wrong and not being very pedagogic in a specific way. But in our A5 project, we are actually conducting an experiment showing that under specific circumstances, providing a negation helps people to understand and to really have clearer idea of the action that is performed.
Yeah. So this sounds actually already very interdisciplinary. So what kind of insights do you think then this research can bring also back to linguistics or psycholinguistics? I mean, you said already, right, that negation in probably in classical psycholinguistic research, it didn't have a very good standing. Right.
No, so it didn't. It was considered as a phenomenon that actually causes costs, additional costs, because in experiment on a screen, when the participants were observed to read actually the negative or positive assertive, so the contrast to negation is assertion, so assertive sentences, they were actually slower to process the negative sentences. But then the research in psycholinguistics suggested that basically it depends on the context. So yes, without that context, participants are slower when processing negative sentences. But depending on the context, if you provide a story against which the negation makes sense, they're actually as fast as for assertive sentences. And we are taking it even further and investigate context of actions. So it is now not a participant sitting in front of a screen and reading a sentence, but a participant who is receiving instructions and seeing really something visible happening. So it is within the context of actions and action demonstration that we are trying to investigate the positive effect of negation. And I think it is a great addition. It's a richer context that we now are able to consider.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So, yeah, thanks for that explanation. However, doesn't it come with a cost? And now I also turn to you. How would you like it? I mean, so we have now heard that, for example, contrasting might be a good way of explaining, but it might also be more associated with more costs for the explainee. Maybe they don't even like it. So I think we often consider or think or just assume that when people understand something, they are more satisfied or happy as compared to when not. But isn't it also the case and possible that it makes life harder for them because they have to think and it's just more annoying to do all these things? And would you think, I'm now looking at Philip, because I think from the computer science perspective, we often expect that humans become, I don't know, more satisfied when technology is better. But do you see this as also as a risk, possibly, that humans might not be happy with technology that expects them to think?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I mean, I think for sure it's the case that if you look at the history of at the development of technology, I mean, typically the technology that is most successful is the one that is the simplest or the
easiest
to consume, right, because at the end, yes, I think cognitive load is an issue. So I mean, if you look at the style nowadays, we have everywhere very smart, lean interfaces with everything we have in our homes. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think at the smart home system like Alexa, I mean, there's even no buttons almost, right? I mean, there's almost no complexity.
Yeah.
So the we're going into a direction where the interfaces get simpler and simpler, and obviously also the information that you can then convey gets also simpler. So I do think that this is a challenge. So this leads one to ask the question if we are on the right track, right? Because we're thinking about what are good explanations that really make people to think or just require some cognitive load. But maybe it's not always the case that people are willing to get the accurate explanations.
Yeah, but this is interesting. Because
they are simply more difficult to process.
Yeah. Yeah? But we are not industry, right? So
yes.
So this is justified, at least. Mm-hmm. But you are absolutely right. And I think the aspect is very interesting to think about, that the explaining or explainable AI, once it is really working, requires actually the humans to think more. So there is a cognitive load, certainly more, and maybe more responsibility as well. So this is... what I was meaning when talking about this taking over, maybe because you explain something, not because after that the explainable AI will take over, but because the people should be maybe motivated to take over. So this is more load, more workload, more responsibility, more cognitive load to them. Yes, I think this is the risk.
I mean, I think if I can add on that, I think there are simply different scenarios at the end of the day. Okay, with the comments I was making towards, you know, leaner and simpler technology, I think that holds mainly for probably what we could call the end user of technology. And there, at the end, explanations might have a role of, you know, being there and being called upon when it's needed. So when there's a certain critical or conflictual situation where we have to resolve it, maybe in the case where everything is smooth, then we don't need to even look at the explanations, but it's good to have them in the background so that we can go back and see, you know, why did something happen or why did something unexpected happen. Mm-hmm. Now, in other scenarios, I do think that people are willing to pay cognitive effort when decisions are really critical. Okay, so for example, if it's about a music recommendation system that recommends me the next piece of music to listen, I might not always want an explanation. that could be very annoying. But maybe if suddenly my music box suggests me something where I say, wow, I wouldn't have expected that. And then I could say, well, why are you suggesting this to me? Then this might help to discover dark sides of oneself.
Well, but if we now think about higher cognitive load, this also opens new chances, right? I mean, you pointed already a little bit in that direction, but couldn't it also be so currently in AI we have like feature importance or counterfactuals or relevance back propagation, stuff like that. Can you imagine that with this research we come up with new with new explainable elements for AI?
I think so, yes. I think the research on explainability will have an impact even on the architectures we consider at all. Because, I mean, bringing in explainability is something that, in my view, cannot always be done only as a post-processing mm-hmm. operation, but maybe changes the very way our exactly. algorithms
yeah.
and the models are built.
Yeah.
So, for example, now I mean there are, I'm not really an expert on that, but I know that there are architectures where, you know, there are additional layers built in that are supposed to be able to explain things in ways that are understandable for humans, and basically by this. By incorporating explainability into the things you're optimizing, then you change also what the algorithm is learning. So explainability can also, the requirement an algorithm to be explainable will also have an impact on what it is able to learn and how it learns.
But that's interesting, right? Because I remember at least at the beginning of RCRC when we were talking, some people had the opinion, and I think people still, some researchers still have that when you bring in explainability, the machine learning becomes worse because now it's optimized, and with explainability, the optimization is missed.
Well, yes, I have a hard time with this. With this trade-off that people often mention, because at the beginning this was often said that, I mean, either you optimize for explainability or you optimize for accuracy. I think that that's a too simplistic way of seeing things. Mm-hmm. Because, in many domains, accuracy doesn't matter that much at the end if you have a human in the loop anyway. Mm-hmm. So my theory would be that if you have a human in the loop anyway that needs to be under control, then whether your model has 5% more or less of accuracy doesn't matter if at the end the human anyway has to control the decision. Then in the human in the loop scenario, the ability for the human to trace and understand what the model is doing is way more important than gaining accuracy. So I think it's a false trade-off. Mm-hmm. If we talk about trading off explainability for accuracy, I don't think that's a good kind of corridor to frame research.
Yeah, so I agree. Maybe
a similar limitation or simplification was also done in research on humans and how they perceive explanations, because a prototypical explanation was research like you have a query. And you then have for the query, you have a verbal response to that, right? But to formulate a query is already a very sophisticated thing. Just to recognize what knowledge you are lacking is an extremely challenging task to do, or achievement. So as Philip mentioned, it is human in the loop means that the human is changing as well. So it is not only the algorithm that is changing, but also the human with the explanation is working, and in her or his brain or mind is also an extension is taking place, and relations are being built and so on. So, and you know, the awareness of knowledge is also rising. So it is a kind of metacognitive achievement as well that is then taking place. So on different levels that are achievements, mental achievements on the human side as well. So I think it is really very dynamic.
So thank you for all the insights and details actually in the research already. And I have the feeling we have already dealt actually with the societal impact of the research this has. And also what kinds of explanation we need actually to, I don't know, to induce trust in the humans.
And agency.
And agency, that's important. And yeah, and actually this is the topic that we would like to follow up on in the next episode. So what makes a good explanation? And how does the act of everyday explaining actually work? And what are the principles of co-construction of explaining? And how can it be applied to AI systems? And about this, I will discuss again with you, Katharina and Philip, in the second episode. So thank you already for giving us insights in your research about explainability, and see you again.
Looking forward to next time.
Same here. See you next time.
Explaining explainability. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you have any questions about this topic, feel free to ask them in the comments. We look forward to welcoming you to our next episode.